This is the Medicast, November 17th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
This episode is the Medicast Live episode recorded on Veterans Day, November 11th, 2008. If you'd like to join us for the next Medicast Live, it's coming up on December 9th. That's the second Tuesday in December, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. You can join us live for our discussion talking about dealing with stress in EMS and some of the things we can do to manage our stress better. Without further ado, here is this month's Medicast Live episode. This is the Medicast Live, November 11th, 2008. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and we are here today on this Veterans Day, November 11th, 2008. And because it's cold weather here in the North American area, we got so many listeners around the world, I have to remember that it's, some of you are heading into summertime, but for some of us, it's getting colder and colder. And we're going to be talking about cold weather emergencies and environmental problems involving hypothermia, frostbite, and things like that. And I urge you, if you're in a warmer climate, to remember that hypothermia can happen in any temperature, really. If you have a patient who has been brought in from extremely hot weather and you have a very air-conditioned ambulance or facility, you can make a patient hypothermic. It doesn't take extreme changes in temperature to do so. So we'll be keeping that in mind and talking a little bit more about that later on here. First off, it is Veterans Day, so everybody who is a veteran out there, I want to extend my appreciation for your contribution to our country and for all of the hard work that you've done to make it possible for me to do things like host a podcast. So I just wanted to say thank you and many future Veterans Days to come. So we're going to be talking today about a couple of different things. First of all, I want to remind you that you can call in on the show. If you have a phone, you call in 1-724-444-7444. And when you call in, you'll be prompted to enter the TalkShoe ID. The ID for the show is 18174. And if you're on the computer screen and watching this in the chat room, you should have a printout or something there on the screen in and around the chat room that'll give you those instructions as well. If not, just chime in the chat room and I'll send those numbers out there in the chat room too. So we're going to be talking about hypothermia, cold-related emergencies, and there's a lot of things that we want to kind of chime in about and think about here as things get a little bit colder. And so first of all, I want to direct you to a couple of different resources, and there'll be links to this in the show notes when this show gets put in the podcast feed this coming weekend. But there are some excellent resources. If you were to search hypothermia and NIH, you would find in one of those top links there a look at hypothermia on the National Institutes of Health webpage. And one of the things that I love about the NIH pages is that a lot of their broader topics, such as cold-related illnesses and hypothermia, they provide a main links landing page that has 20 or 30 different links to authoritative sites with a variety of different topics around that general topic area. So if you get to this page, and there'll be a link in the show notes, maybe I can put it in the chat room too. Let me go ahead and do that. So those of you that are in the chat room can see that link. You can go to this page and you can really see a lot of great things talking about hypothermia. And there are flash tutorials talking about cold weather injuries. There are Spanish language versions of the site. A lot of things from the CDC talking about winter weather emergencies. And the CDC is involved for preventing this. And, you know, cold weather emergencies are largely preventable. And that's something that we need to keep in mind. We want to make sure that we help patients that call in and have problems with cold weather emergencies, but we also want to make sure that we don't cause additional cold weather emergencies or hypothermia. And we can do that very quickly because the nature of hypothermia. You know, we can cause patients to start shivering in the middle of the summertime if we have our air conditionings turned up too high. And I see this happen a lot when we get to moving around and get our, you know, get things going, and we're all adrenalined up and we're starting to sweat because we're working hard trying to help these patients out. And the patients come into our units and we've got the air conditioning cranked because we're uncomfortable. And what turns out is that we end up making the patients colder. So I've got the link for this particular site in the show notes. I urge you guys to check it out. There's a lot of good resources there, and that's just a starting point. There are a lot of other things that I found, and we're going to be talking about those this evening. Now, the bad news is I had some guests lined up for tonight, and because of a coordinated system of events, nobody was able to make it. Last minute cancellations. So we're going to be going here with the information that I've gathered, which I always try to put together information to help keep the show moving along. But I'm going to rely a lot on all of you. You know, we all bring something to the table, and one of the things I really enjoy is learning a lot about different topics from somebody else's tricks of the trade. You know, we all come up with different ways of doing things. And, you know, something as simple as starting an IV on a patient, you can watch somebody else's technique and just pick up a little something that helps you the next time you're doing it. And so I hope that we can all pick up something like that from each other here, whether it's in the chat room or in a live call. So there are a lot of things that we can do to protect our patients and protect ourselves from cold weather and from having problems with hypothermia. First off, I want to talk a little bit about hypothermia. And again, anybody that wants to chime in or add something here, please feel free to jump in the chat room. I'm going to go ahead and talk a little bit about some of the things that I think we need to keep in mind about hypothermia. First of all, you know, we have some patients that are at greater risk for problems with cold weather emergencies and hypothermia. And these are, just as in most cases, the very young and the very old are more susceptible to injury from cold weather. And in the case of very young children and infants, they don't have the temperature regulation mechanisms that we have, and they have a greater body surface area to mass ratio. And so they have a lot of more surface area to lose heat from compared to their body mass. So that makes them at greater risk. And for elderly patients, they have less subcutaneous fat, they have a slower metabolism, and so these combine to making it so that they are unable to adequately protect themselves from severe cold. And so it's important for us to keep in mind that some people are at greater risk for cold weather emergencies. Of course, there are other comorbid factors. There are things that we deal with, like patients who have diabetes. So they have peripheral vascular problems and they have peripheral neuropathy. They don't feel that they're getting cold as quickly. They are more susceptible. Also, patients who are diabetic, if they do become hypothermic and begin shivering, they begin using up their glucose stores more quickly, and it may throw their sugar off much faster than it would in a healthy person because they're already having issues with their glucose maintenance. And if we do something that uses up their medications faster, uses up their available stores of glucose faster, they are more likely to become hypoglycemic after having some problems with hypothermia. Eddie adds some information such as pharmacological effects on cold like beta blockers, and that's absolutely right, Eddie, in the chat room. Shirley asks about immunosuppressed patients. Well, immunosuppressed patients are always at greater risk for some other problems. I don't know if that necessarily puts them at greater risk for hypothermia simply because it's an external effect, but anything that reduces the body's ability to protect itself, I think the hypothermia is more likely to cause them to become even further immunocompromised. And that would be my guess just off the top of my head. I think that when the body's defenses are already weakened and cold comes in and further weakens the body's ability to protect itself, that an immunosuppressed patient could be more at risk for an opportunistic infection following a bout with hypothermia. So the injury or problem may not happen immediately, but may come about later on as they become more susceptible as a result of the cold to further infection and further opportunistic problems. And that would be my quick off the top of my head guess, and maybe I'll make a note to try to look that up. So if we have more folks joining us in the chat room, feel free to call in on the phone line. We are going to be talking about cold weather emergencies and hypothermia. And this doesn't just restrict us to patients with problems with frostbite and other issues. We can be talking about hypothermia that occurs in a facility, patients that are in their homes because they're trying to save money on their heat, have their heat dialed down too far, and so they become susceptible to being increased risk, especially if they have some of these other issues like we were talking about. What we also want to think about when we look at hypothermia is there's some other issues that can come along with this and comorbid factors. One of them is alcohol use. Alcohol use is going to cause a couple of different physiological things to occur that are going to make these patients more susceptible to hypothermia. When somebody drinks alcohol, they think they're warmer, but actually it's causing peripheral vasodilation. And so the body's natural response to cold, which is to constrict the peripheral blood vessels to reduce heat loss, actually doesn't happen. And so these patients actually lose heat faster. So we need to make sure that we are staying on top of getting a good history on our patients and really understanding what else is going on so that we can make sure that we take care of those folks. So let's talk about some of the other issues with understanding hypothermia. Eddie chimes in the chat room talking about a PHTLS text that talks about cold temperatures that makes issues getting temperatures from patients hard. And there's a couple of things that we can think about there. First of all, a lot of times when you read hypothermia texts, they're talking about core body temperature. Well, you know, you guys don't have a reliable way in the field, as you know, in the back of an ambulance, to necessarily get a reliable core temperature. First of all, not many people are going to sit still and let you take a rectal temp. And so we need to think in other directions. We need to kind of look at signs and symptoms, at history, at time of exposure, and then make an educated guess at what their core temperature range is. Not necessarily getting a good core temperature, but getting a core temperature range. So what we need to think about are just some of the things that we can keep in mind. Now, one of the things, if you do have the ability to take an oral temperature or a tympanic temperature, anything really below a 96 degree Fahrenheit, and that would be 35 degrees Celsius, we're going to be considering it starting towards the danger zone. These patients may well be okay and are able to protect themselves, but they are starting to get into the point where they're going to be chilled, they're going to start shivering, and we want to warm them up. We want to make sure that we can get rid of that shivering and have them warm and conscious and alert. Some of the other signs and symptoms besides shivering, and this is the body's natural reaction to warm up. By making the muscles quiver, it actually releases more heat from the muscular activity. But it uses up glucose stores, it uses up energy in general, and eventually it can't keep the body warm by itself. So the body will continue to lose heat, and the body will continue to get colder. And as it does that, the patient will continue to deteriorate. If a patient is still cold and is not shivering anymore, and you have not begun to rewarm them, this is a danger sign. This is the body, just like any other shock response, this is the body beginning to break down in its ability to protect itself. And so I think that we need to keep in mind that we need to monitor our patients and we need to get them out of the situation they're in that's making them cold. So let's look at our signs and symptoms. First of all, we talked about shivering. Also, confusion, sleepiness, altered mental status is always an ominous sign. We may see signs of a weak pulse or a low blood pressure because we've decreased the ability of the body's decreased its peripheral pulses. The body's also beginning to slow down. Bradycardia is going to set in a more advanced hypothermia. Patients may be in a cold environment. So, you know, if you know they've been out walking around, you have their Alzheimer's patients that leave the house in cold weather and wander off. Well, you know, we need to be aware that, first of all, they're elderly, and second of all, they're in a cold environment. They're at increased risk for further altered mental status or decreased level of consciousness. Also, patients tend to be stumbling and they mumble. One of the texts that I have, and it'll be a link I provide for you, talks about looking for the umbles, U-M-B-L-E-S. And the umbles refers to stumbles, mumbles, fumbles, and grumbles. And this is basically people's reaction to cold. They get grumpy. They begin to mumble and slur their speech. They begin to be unable to coordinate their body motions and be unable to walk effectively. So all of these are signs of early onset of hypothermia. And left untreated, it can progress, of course, to more serious concerns. Now, of course, Shirley adds in that not only are they in danger of progressing to unconsciousness and lack of reduced level of consciousness, but in fact, they can become bradycardic and in fact go into cardiac arrest and become apneic. And that's exactly right. And in fact, there are some specific guidelines for cold weather emergencies, and we'll touch on those a little bit later, from the American Heart Association. And they have an excellent PDF that you can download that spells out both BLS and ALS expectations for treatment of cardiac arrest patients, and as well as an algorithm to look at. So that's something else to keep in mind, is that there will be specific algorithms to follow for BCLS and ACLS concerns. So what about your own protocols? Well, everybody's going to have slightly different things, and there's two different schools of thought out there for field treatment of hypothermia. And this does not usually carry into the facilities, because the docs have their own opinions and may do different things. But there's the active rewarming versus passive rewarming camps. Active rewarming is using things like heated humidified oxygen and using heated IV fluids. These fluids, putting in IV fluids that are at 70 degrees Fahrenheit is not good if a person's hypothermic. If you had a normally healthy person that wasn't hypothermic, it wouldn't be that big of an issue to be running some fluid into them, even at a KVO rate. But what happens when you run cold fluids into a person who's already cold? You're just compounding the problem. So there are products out there that warm IV fluids. There are some other things that we can do, and we'll talk about those a little bit later on. So we also need to be thinking about some of the other things that go along with cold weather. And so patients might be cold. They might be taking steps to warm themselves, either in their home or if they're in a vehicle and trapped. And so you may have altered mental status as a result of other issues. They may have been drinking and trying to think they can get warmer by drinking alcohol, and that's not going to work. We already talked about that. But that's going to also alter their mental status. So they may be altered not only because of cold, but because of alcohol use or drug abuse. Patients who are trying to use improper heating tools or have inadequately serviced heating in their home, or using a car to try to stay warm if they're trapped or their car is stopped for some reason, are all at risk for carbon monoxide poisoning. And this also can cause altered mental status. And you need to be aware of the fact that they may have carbon monoxide poisoning depending on their presentation and depending on the history of the event. So we need to keep a couple of different things in the back of our mind. One of the things I talk about all the time is getting a really good history. If you take the time to get a good history while you're working with a patient, talking to family members, talking to bystanders, taking an extra few seconds to get a good history can save you a lot down the road, because something may trigger a memory when you're halfway to the hospital, when something occurs that you weren't expecting, that'll say, wait a minute, I asked a question about this, and that's right. They have carbon monoxide poisoning. Somebody said they were in the car. Those type of things can occur. So our basic treatments of some of these things are going to be very similar to everything else. First off, we're just like any other rescue situation, we're going to want to get them out of the environment that's causing them the issue. And just like you get them out of a motor vehicle when they have been in a motor vehicle accident and away from danger, we want to get them out of the cold environment. So step one is to remove them from the environment. The next thing is that you want to get them out of any wet clothing that they might be wearing. A lot of times people can become hypothermic because of immersion in water. And when this happens, they become wet and they start losing heat even faster because of the fact that other factors of heat loss are coming into play when their clothing's wet and you have wet clothing against wet skin. So we want to get them out of anything wet that they're wearing. Strip them down all the way if you have to, and then wrap them up quickly in blankets and sheets and warm them up again. They're not going to get warmed again wrapping them up in cold clothes with blankets on top. You're just going to end up with cold, wet clothes and cold, wet blankets. So we want to make sure that we get them out of the cold and wet clothing and then wrap them up in dry blankets. Eddie asks a question that's very important. Is there a danger in warming people up too quickly? This comes back to that passive versus active rewarming. Passive rewarming is really just basically bringing them into a warm environment, wrapping them up, and letting their own body's radiant heat trapped inside of blankets and such, just like you do it in bed at night, trap that heat under the blankets and warm up that way. A lot of people can have problems because of your body's natural reaction to the cold is to constrict the blood vessels in the periphery. If you apply heat to the peripheral skin, you end up, the skin will actually dilate the blood vessels. So there's a local reaction that will occur when heat's there. And that's because the body locally is trying to avoid getting heat, avoid having too much heat applied. And so it dilates those blood vessels. And what you can have happen is the body's constricted it, but the heat has caused those peripheral areas to dilate prematurely, and you end up with a container issue from the shock standpoint. So what ends up happening is they end up becoming hypotensive. Low blood pressure can onset rapidly. Now, if you know this is going to happen, if you are looking for it, and you've got a patient who's hypothermic, you should treat them as a priority one patient, a high priority patient. You should be taking their vitals every 5 minutes or so. You should be monitoring them carefully. If you are watching this and you're trending them appropriately, you're getting your blood pressures on a regular basis, and you're taking their pulse and you're watching the patient and you're monitoring them, you should see improvement. And if you see a sudden drop in blood pressure, then you know you're warming them up too fast. So, you know, it's one of those things you can kind of play it by ear. Yeah, you can rewarm them too fast, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But you need to also try to warm them. And I don't think bringing them into the back of a warm ambulance with the heat on and wrapping them in blankets is necessarily going to warm them up too fast. You're more likely to warm them up too fast by doing things like applying too much heat directly to their body. People like to use warm blankets, and warm blankets are good for patients that are moderately cold, you know, moderate hypothermia. But you may not necessarily want to do that unless you've been told to do so by your protocols or medical direction, unless you're really monitoring these patients carefully. Because as Kelly points out, you want to make sure that you try to warm them from the core outward. Warmed IV fluids, warmed humidified oxygen gets that warmed into the core first, and then the body will do the rest. The body will take that warmer core and use blood to pump it out to the periphery. Scooter asks in the chat room, does anyone use foil rescue blankets? You know, they're actually an excellent tool. Those foil rescue blankets work under the principle that they are going to reflect heat in. And Kenny, you're still on the line there. I'm going to ask you a question because I know you have a history in firefighting. Would you like to explain to the folks on the show exactly how heat exchange occurs? How does heat loss occur for our patients? There's four general ways that heat exchange occurs. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've got a couple of them. I think I'm going to probably need some help. The primary one is, of course, head and skin. Cooling and sweat being on the skin dissipates that heat quickly. The periphery dissipates heat when it's dilated and not receiving blood. And then the other areas is breathing that I could come up with that dissipates a lot of heat. So, and I'm missing the fourth one.
The fourth one. Well, the big ones are, first of all, convection, and that's the movement of air across the skin, and it evaporates sweat, and of course, if you have wet skin and wet clothing, that convection is actually going to evaporate air faster. You have evaporation, so convection and evaporation work together. This is how we stay cool when we're sweating and it's hot outside. Our body stays cool through this method, but it's not a good thing when you're hypothermic. So we need to get the wet off the skin to remove the evaporation, and then we need to cover up the skin to protect them from convection. The other forms are radiation and conduction. So the skin itself, if they're laying on a sidewalk outside and you haven't thought enough to move them to a stretcher and get them in the back of the ambulance, they're losing heat directly from the conduction contact of skin to the pavement. That pavement's cold and it's soaking up the heat from their body. Finally, we just have radiation. We radiate heat all the time by putting someone inside one of those foil blankets, those foil rescue blankets. We're actually taking that radiant heat and reflecting it back onto the body. We're reflecting it. We're not letting it go through the foil. And you wouldn't think that those blankets, those Mylar blankets, are that effective, but they are very effective. Particularly effective if you're in a situation where you have a young child, somebody like that. You know, neonates, we always pull one out if we have an imminent delivery and have it ready, because it's a great thing to use to help keep a neonate warm just after delivery, after you've gotten them resuscitated and ready to go. So that's something that that works very well. But yeah, those, you're absolutely right, Kenny. And those are the four big ones, and convection, conduction, evaporation, and radiation. And I think you hit all of them. You just combine a couple of them, but I think they work. Shirley's asking about heat packs. That would be considered active rewarming. Again, you may be urged to use a heat pack. The challenge with using anything that is a chemical or an electrical heat source is that if the body is very cold and the body's peripheral circulation is not adequate or working at all because of frostbite or because of extremely slowed blood movement, the body's normal protection from heat is to move blood through and cool. Okay, so we're actually causing too much heat in a localized area can be a problem. We can actually cause localized burns from applying too much heat to an area that doesn't have adequate circulation. So again, you need to kind of follow your own protocols and also monitor your patient. Now, every patient's going to be different. First of all, you should never use heat packs or cold packs directly in contact with the skin. That's first off, because both of those things can cause localized problems. Cold packs can cause localized frostbite if you're not careful, or localized cooling to areas of the skin. So we always want to wrap these things in a towel or something before we apply them. So let's talk about some tricks of the trade. And this is where I'm going to have everybody kind of jump in here. And Kelly, if you have any tricks, you know, jump in and add your 2 cents worth here. But I'm going to give you my two big ones that I use all the time in cold weather. Both of these I got out of a magazine article too many years ago to remember. And I can't remember if it was EMS Magazine or GEMS, but it was one of the two. And it was a tip talking about cold weather. And it talked about having a blanket warmer in every ambulance. Now, how many of you think you have a blanket warmer in your ambulances out there? And I'm waiting for a show of hands, but I suspect that none of you really think. But Kelly's right. Kelly chimes in, your engine. And this is something that we all need to keep in mind. When I roll up on a call for a motor vehicle accident in cold weather, and a lot of my drivers know this already, I tell them to put the defroster on full as soon as we get there, and I put 2 rolled blankets up on the dashboard right on top of the defroster outlets. Okay, now I've got 2 warmed blankets ready to go. Anytime I need them, I can send somebody to the unit and pull them off that dashboard. So if we've got an extended rescue situation in cold weather, I've got some warm blankets to pull out and throw on the patient. Okay, instant warm blankets. The other thing you can do is roll up those blankets, throw an IV bag, keep it in its sterile containers. No need to open it right now. We may not need it. Throw an IV bag in there and roll it up inside the blanket. Okay, it's not going to get so hot that it's going to cause a problem. And if it did, you just use another IV bag. But it's something to keep in mind. You can have another way to warm some of your fluids up, at least getting them up closer to body temperature. And so when you need to give fluids, you've got fluid that's warmer than it was when it was just sitting in the back of the unit. So those are 2 things. The other thing is, if you need to bring fluids out into the cold with you, you know, fluid will get cold and stay cold for a long time. So we need to protect that fluid. So I either put it inside my own jacket and zip it up, or if I'm working on the patient and I can't have stuff falling out of my jacket, I will hand it to a responder or a bystander at the scene and tell them to tuck that under their armpit and keep it warm Okay, now it's still in its sterile container, so we don't have stinky fluids, but we've got an opportunity here to keep the fluid warm. And if I need to start an IV, I'll get that bag spiked, and I'll go ahead and give it back to somebody to put under their coat. And we'll keep that fluid at body temperature, even if we're flowing it into a patient outside, if we're in the middle of a rescue situation. One of the things I want to urge you to do, last year in the Medicast, I think back probably the very last podcast of the year, I picked up an episode of Rick Rosati's podcast, The Mitigation Journal, where he related a rescue in an elevator that occurred in an industrial facility. And it was, I think, -4 degrees. Okay. It was in an ice plant in the wintertime. And they specifically talked about the challenges of dealing with hypothermia in trapped trauma patients. There were two people trapped in that elevator, and they ended up having a person trapped by a shifted forklift when the elevator collapsed inside the shaft. And they had this guy trapped in that, by that forklift for an extended period of time in extreme cold. And they had to treat him for hypothermia on the scene before they could even get him out. It's an excellent story of incident command working together, of medical command, helicopter paramedics, on-the-ground paramedics, and medical command all getting together and planning for a rescue situation that was difficult and hard to do and dangerous, and they pulled it off. So we need to think about how we'd handle that. Now, Eddie asks a question, and Let's see. Eddie, your question is, might be a silly question. First off, let's go ahead and say it. Everybody together, there are no silly questions. So let's start off there. In a trauma patient who's bleeding and the patient is hypothermic, which issue do you do first? Well, first off, we're going to go through our ABCs. In your initial assessment, you're going to handle airway problems, then you're going to handle breathing problems, and then you're going to handle circulation or bleeding problems. So if you have a patient with an active bleed that is out of control, you're going to control bleeding first. What's the body's primary way of getting heat around the body? It's through the blood. If they lose too much blood, they will become hypothermic no matter what the temperature is outside. Unless it's 98.6 degrees outside, anything less than that, and they lose too much blood, hypothermia will occur. So we need to control blood loss, and then we need to keep them warm and handle that. And this comes back to dealing with comorbid factors, Eddie. So that's an excellent question. When you have patients that have other problems going on, such as multi-system trauma, such as being trapped in a rescue situation, you need to think about things like what else is going on. If somebody has a possibility for having internal injuries, they're losing fluid internally, and that lost fluid is no longer available to heat the body. So you need to be thinking about ways to heat the body. Kenny, you had a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in there. And I think anybody in shock is prone to hypothermia because their metabolism is very decreased, and they just can't metabolize and get heat buildup. So maintaining blood pressure and trying to treat for shock is absolutely vital. And keeping them warm is also reduces the chances of shock because it's the body's mechanism to keep it warm. So that causes more shock to occur. So we can do both, maintain blood pressure with fluids that are warm, and get bleeding stopped and prevent other types of shock from occurring or treating it, they benefit much, much greater from our care.
Excellent point, Ken. I appreciate that. And there's nothing that says we can't do more than one thing at a time. So, obviously your initial assessment process is to stop the bleeding when you see it. But then once you've managed that or gotten at least a head start on that, the next step is to start treating the big picture. And start pulling in your resources as you need them. You know, there's nothing that says we can't, go start cycling those blankets off the dashboard as needed. You know, pull one off, make sure they put another one back to replace it so it's ready for the next time you need it. I will tell you, you will get the biggest grin from somebody's face if they're cold and chilled and they're conscious. You know, we want to worry about not rewarming them too quickly. But if you have a conscious patient who is just a little cold and you put a warm blanket on them, you've done more. I mean, you could have given them pain medication or whatever. I've never seen a thank you from somebody like I've gotten from a cold person who you put a warm blanket on. And I don't know if anyone else has had that impact, but it is just something about getting somebody warm again that just has a very calming, just a therapeutic effect. And so, you know, again, it comes down to BLS, BLS, BLS. We're there for patient care. We can have all the bells and whistles, all the extra skills. We still need to look at the patient, figure out what the problem is, and then initiate the simplest treatment that we can right away, and then move on to other things that we need to do. Of course, if there are advanced things that are needed right away, we do that, but sometimes it's the simple things that make a big difference. Scooter says it's challenging to undress patients sometimes, frozen wet clothing, stuck zippers, frozen steel-toe boots, and things like that. You're absolutely right, Scooter. That's what trauma shears are for. We can cut through just about everything with those things. And I carry two of them on me almost all the time when I'm on the unit. And that's because I hand them to other people. I rarely cut clothing anymore because I'm busy trying to do other things. So I will hand those scissors to other responders at the scene and say, get those pants off, get that shirt off. I need access right now. You know, we can cut through frozen stuff if we have to. But it's key to get that frozen stuff off of people and important. Eddie has a comment, you know, warm blanket out of the dryer. He likes that, right? Well, I'll tell you what, if you're in somebody's home or, you know, you're outside of a house, there's nothing. Ask if they have a dryer. Go take one of your blankets in there and throw it in the dryer for 5 minutes. You know, that's, you know, one of the things that makes good EMS providers, and I'm sure Ken would agree with me here, one of the things that makes a really good EMS provider is a person who can improvise and think on their feet. So, you need to, you know, utilize the resources you have. If the patient has a dryer nearby, use the dryer while you're there. If it's easier to do that, then go out to your unit and use the defroster or make that trip and come back. So think about other things.
We've got a couple other tools that we use in Colorado. First is we have IV warmers, fluid warmers that are just a tray that we set all our IV fluids on. And it really helps. You can throw a couple underneath the patient's armpits, and they love you all the way in because they're warming up quick. And our warm fluids, you know, we've for years gave those cold fluids, and sitting in a bay, we usually see our ambulance temperatures drop into 60s and 50s. So we're really necessity. We have to have IV warmers, and I think it's a great asset for any ambulance to have. I've seen a lot of people use hot pads to heat up their IV fluids, and we've talked with the manufacturer and found that they could get them too hot where it really can harm the plastic and it starts leaching into the fluid. So they don't recommend using anything above 100 degrees. And that's a common thing, though, is hot packs or electric hot pads that when they're plugged in the bay, they keep them warm, which I don't think is a good idea. So 100 degrees is good. We like a product for like hike-ins where we have to hike in our long extrication. It's a product that's called Thermal Angel Blood and IV Fluid Infuser. It's battery operated. They're about $65 for a use. They're disposable, and they heat the fluid through a tubing that goes to about 100 degrees. And it's been a really good hike-in tool that we've used. And then the other thing we do with our blankets is we sneak them in right next to the inverter when we're plugged into the bay, the warm charger unit, or the inverter if you use inverters. And we stick our blankets in there and keep the compartment warm all the time so that if somebody forgets to throw in the dash, we've got it right there. And it's good as long as you don't cover up the heat sink for the electronics. It's a great way to keep blankets warm right underneath the cap and shears, whereas ours is always stored.
Great. Thank you very much. And it's something to keep in mind. You know, there are using the right tool for the right job is important. I've always found that I can warm up IV fluids pretty quickly just by tucking it inside my own jacket or somebody else's jacket and having them zip it up. Just that much warmth can make a big difference to get the fluid started towards body temperature. You know, there are excellent IV fluid warmers out there. There are fluid warmers that you can actually hook your IV tubing to that runs it through a little battery-operated warmer that warms it to the appropriate temperature. It monitors the temperature coming in and going out, so it regulates itself, and those devices are out there. And I don't know all of the manufacturers, but you can search for IV fluid warmers. Portable IV fluid warmers will probably get you a couple of different choices if that's something you want to think about. We're moving on into the show here, and I want to move on and talk a little bit about some of the cardiac concerns, because there are some specific cardiac problems that go along with cold weather emergencies, and we would be definitely remiss if we didn't touch base on them at least briefly. One of the things is that the American Heart Association has some excellent guidelines. I'll have some links in the show notes coming up this weekend when the show goes out in the regular podcast feed. So you want to look at that. But if you go to and you search hypothermia guidelines, you should be able to find this. Some of the things that you need to keep in mind is that the cardiac muscle, the myocardium, is irritable. One of the things that makes the myocardium good at what it does is that the myocardium is able to start itself. It's the way the heart has its own pacemakers built into it, is that that the myocardium itself is able to conduct and transfer the signal onto the next level of heart cells. So when it does that, you know, it's a good thing. The problem is that because it's irritable, if you kind of get it out of whack for whatever reason, whether it's through an electrical shock, whether it's through a cardiac conduction problem, whether it's through hypoxia, whether it's through cold weather, the cardiac muscle becomes irritable. And when it happens, you have patients who are at increased risk for going into ventricular fibrillation. Especially patients who become very, very cold. And we're talking about patients that get down below 86 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 30 degrees Celsius. These patients are considered severe. They are, if they haven't gone into cardiac arrest yet, they're probably very close to going into cardiac arrest. And these patients need to be treated gently. So we don't want to be jostling them around any more than we have to. We want to, if we're warming them and we're wrapping them up, if we're cutting clothes off of them, we need to do it, but we need to keep in mind that we want to do it with as little body movement as possible, because anything that jostles their body can cause them to go into cardiac arrest with ventricular fibrillation. And the problem is that if they're severely hypothermic and they're in V-fib, they are not receptive to shock as much. They are not receptive to cardiac medications. None of this is going to work until you warm them up again, and their heart's not pumping, so they're not going to be able to easily warm themselves up from the core. This is another cascading scale of issues, and you really need to keep in mind that there's a whole lot of problems associated with it. So I'm going to just go down here and talk a little bit about this. First of all, the American Heart Association recommends that if you have a hypothermic patient that has not yet developed cardiac arrest as far as BLS care, you want to focus on rewarming the patient first. Handle them gently for any procedures or anything you need to do, physical manipulations of any kind. You want to just be as gentle as possible. If they are in cardiac arrest, the first thing you do is manage their airway, breathing, circulation, just like you always do. But you may not be able to adequately assess their respiratory rate or their pulse if you're not taking a little extra time to do so. Let's review. We are trained now to quickly and rapidly assess whether the patient's breathing in like 10 seconds and assess for the patient's pulse in 10 seconds. Well, if you have somebody who is severely depressed because of hypothermia, you have a patient who may not be breathing more than, you know, six times a minute, which means if you check them for 10 seconds, they may not have taken a breath in that time frame. And it may be a very shallow, hard to detect breath. The same thing is true for their pulse. It may be very thready, weak pulse that is hard to detect, and it probably is bradycardic. When that happens, you need to make sure that you're aware that you need to take a little bit longer. The American Heart Association and patients that you have hypothermia suspicions, you need to assess their pulse for a period of 30 to 45 seconds. You need to assess their respiratory rate for 30 to 45 seconds to confirm pulselessness and apnea. So this is their recommendation in the modifications for BLS care and hypothermia. And then if they're not breathing and they're pulseless, or if they're bradycardic, severely bradycardic, you want to consider initiating CPR anyway. this is going to be within your own guidelines. So refer to your protocols and do what's expected. We need to rewarm these patients, though. So if they're in a cold environment, it's recommended you get them out of the cold environment somewhere warm and then initiate your BLS care, because trying to perform CPR in an environment where they're just going to get colder isn't going to do them any good. They're also at reduced temperature, so defibrillation is not likely to be effective. If they are in ventricular fibrillation and you attach an AED to them and they have a shock indicated, go ahead and administer one single shock and then go back and begin CPR again and continue with CPR. But another shock is not indicated until they've been warmed back up beyond the range of 30 degrees Celsius or warmer than 86 degrees Fahrenheit. We need to get them into a more viable range. Their body is not going to be able to process cardiac medications like epinephrine or atropine. They're just not going to be able to handle it. It's not going to work for them. Medications like amiodarone, lidocaine as well, are going to have reduced effectiveness because of the chilling effect of the hypothermia. So we need to warm them back up again. In situations of cardiac arrest, active rewarming is likely to be more indicated. So again, the patient no longer possesses the ability to circulate warm blood themselves, so they can't warm themselves up. So you may have to come up with some way to initiate some form of active rewarming. Talk to medical control, tell them what you've got on hand, assess how far you are from the nearest facility that might have active rewarming available. Active rewarming available in the hospital, they'll do things like peritoneal lavage, thoracic lavage. And what they basically do is they put tubes in the chest and the abdomen and they flush warm fluids through those cavities and get the fluids into the core and warm the core up that way. But if you have a cardiac arrest patient, you're going to have to try to rapidly rewarm them as much as possible and make sure that you are keeping that in mind as well. So that's your BLS concerns. Obviously, rendezvous with ALS if you have an opportunity to do so, and also assess the closest facility. Your normal transport facility may not always be indicated if you have another facility that can do the job closer. And it may even be an urgent care facility because they may have a trained ER physician in there that has the necessary tools to do some active rewarming on a patient. If you have a transport time that might be 15 to 20 minutes shorter, it might be indicated to go to that closer facility, even though it's not a full ER. You have to talk to your medical control and assess for that. What about ACLS concerns? Well, again, we want to make sure that we use our normal ACLS tools, and we, again, are only going to be normally indicated for one shock when the patient is severely hypothermic until we get that core temperature back up. One of the problems we have in the field is that we don't necessarily, again, have a way to adequately assess core temperature. Make your best guess, do the best you can, talk with your medical control, and then see what happens. You're going to give that single shock, and then you're going to probably withhold IV medications until you can get them warmed up to a point where they'll work. It's also recommending, because of the decreased level of effect of the IV medications, that the space between administration of drugs is spread out. So instead of giving meds every 5 minutes or so, 3 to 5 minutes, it might be more indicated to move that to every 7, 8, 10 minutes. And so you'll need to talk to your physicians about that, whether they want you to slow down. We don't want to overload these patients with medications that have not been adequately metabolized because they're hypothermic. And then we rewarm them and, you know, the triple dose of amiodarone hits their system or the extra lidocaine hits their system. And we end up snowing them completely and throwing them into other arrhythmias because they have too much of a drug on board. So keep that in mind as well. Again, remember, they are at an increased risk for irritability. So if you have a patient who's bradycardic, work on rewarming them. The thing that's going to make them not bradycardic faster is to rewarm them. It may not be indicated to pace these patients. It may not be indicated to administer atropine to these patients. Because if the problem is cold and you can warm them up, you'll end up with a warm patient with atropine on board, or you'll attach pacer pads to somebody and send them into VFib. You have to really be careful with what you do with these folks. So that's a quick look at our American Heart Association guidelines. I'd like to ask a couple of questions out there right now. Anybody else have any other tips or tricks that they use to treat patients that are dealing with hypothermia? I know we've had a couple of things talked about in the chat room, and we've brought them up as it's come up. Kelly has brought up a couple of things, and we appreciate her experience. She's got a long experience as a ski patrol member and works very hard in her area in search and rescue efforts. Kenny, anything else you'd like to add this evening?
The only thing else that and I'm not really able to speak about it, maybe you can, Jamie, is Osborne waves on the EKG starting to progress and making that an assessment tool before you get rested on resuscitation to get a good EKG and look for Osborne waves.
You know what? I'm not going to even attempt it. It's not something I'm familiar with.
Okay, well, at the J point on a hypothermic patient, I've seen it a couple times, they'll start to have their J point start to slur, and it starts to look like ST changes. And it causes the heart to just slowly repolarize. And the more the Osborne wave grows or the J point changes, the patient becomes more susceptible to VTAC BFibs, fib more likely than not. So we've always been taught that if you see J point changes, stop off all medications. It's just not going to be helpful, I mean, unless you have an arrest. But it does progress eventually to a sine wave, and that's what causes them to go into fib. Is that the repolarization gets slower. And we've seen in Colorado just occasionally J-point changes, particularly like in our wet, cold spring snowstorms in Colorado. They get really wet and they get hypothermic, and then we put them on a monitor and we see it. And it's a pretty ominous sign and severe hypothermia. It's one tool that we use to, since we don't have any kind of fancy thermometers, we use that to assess the critical condition of the patient.
Well, excellent, Ken. I really appreciate you bringing that up, and it's something I'm going to have to look up. I've made a note of that, Osborne waves. And, you know, it's something I thought I'd heard of them before, but I wasn't quite sure, and I'm glad you were able to explain that for us. Obviously, we need to keep in mind some other things. We talked about neonatal situations and young children. We always, you know, we joke about when people are very cold, we joke about skin-to-skin contact being the best way to warm somebody up. And, you know, it might sound like a sleazy lounge act, but there's actually some truth to that. One of the things that is used to treat hypothermia in newborns, even in a delivery room situation, is that a lot of facilities are really going for the rapid skin-to-skin contact between the mother and the child. First of all, it's a great bonding moment, and it's great for the mother and child, but they don't just do it for that reason. It's a better way to keep the child warm than just to put them under a warming lamp in the bassinet. And so this is something that we can keep in mind when you have children. For instance, you have a school bus accident. Okay, most school bus accidents really aren't that bad. I mean, first of all, the bus is a big old bus, and unless it's been traveling on a major highway, it probably hasn't been going all that fast. So you have accidents that occur, but they most often end up with bumps and bruises, fender bender type stuff. Usually the other vehicle is much worse off. But now you have a bus on the side of the road, and maybe its engine's off now because of the accident, and you have a bunch of kids that are at various ages that are starting to get cold. And so we need to keep in mind that we have at-risk populations. And one of the things that I have proposed when we've had situations like that is, first off, if we are in an area where we have a home nearby and the homeowner's there, we ask them if we can open the front of the home up and put everybody inside that, you know, we've checked them for injuries, walking wounded or whatever, put them there and then start there. If you don't have that access, putting the heaters on inside the cab of your rescue or your engine on scene, if you've already got people in the back of the ambulance and you just, you know, you have patients that aren't injured but need to stay warm so that we don't end up having to deal with hypothermic patients because we didn't have anywhere to put them. These are things they can do too, is put them inside the cab. Obviously, you don't want to leave children unattended in the back of the cab of an engine, or you'll end up with all kinds of things turned on. But you certainly can have somebody there to keep an eye on them, occupy them, and another adult to keep an eye on them. So something to keep in mind. If you have small children, you know, again, in a situation like that, having the parents open their coat and wrap around the kids and using the combined body heat to keep warm is certainly a viable option. Eddie asks another question. Eddie, you always come up with such good questions. Obese patients, are they less likely to be patients on hypothermic calls? Generally, I would say that obese patients, at least initially, are less likely to be hypothermic, at least in a normal situation. But the other issue you have is that obese patients also are not very active patients, and so they have reduced muscle mass. While they're able to keep warmer because of the increased subcutaneous fat, they are probably less likely to protect themselves in extreme cold situations from the cold. So if they're in a situation where they get cold, they're less likely to be able to get themselves warm back up again. So it's something to keep track of. And as Scooter points out, circulation problems are issues as well. So we'll have to kind of get ready to close out here. And I just want to thank everybody, first of all, for joining us. The chat room was very active today, and it's always good to hear from everybody. Ken, I want to thank you very much for your contributions tonight. It was great to have you on the show and have you participate.
As always, Mike Peter.
Great. All right. Listen, I forgot to give away T-shirts last month, so we're going to give away two T-shirts here tonight. So everybody that's listening on the show, you're going to need to send me an email. And my email address, for those of you that don't know it, is podmedic@mac.com. Let me go ahead and put that into the chat room. And you will send that to me at that email address. You're going to put in the subject line, okay, we're ready for this? Shirt me, S-H-I-R-T-M-E, shirt me. And what I will do is I will randomly choose from the people that send me that email. By tomorrow morning, I will go ahead and randomly choose two of you to get a T-shirt. Now, in that email, you also want to give me your mailing address and your T-shirt size. And then I will go ahead and select two winners and send two T-shirts out to you folks. And I want to thank you very much, because one of the things that makes the Medicast Live so fun is the fact that everybody participates and joins in on the call, and both in the chat room and as Kenny did on the phone. So I want to thank everybody for helping out tonight, and for adding your conversation, for adding your tips and your tricks. And we'll be talking a little bit more about this. If you have any other comments or things that you think of after the fact, don't hesitate to shoot me an email. I may just put an additional post on the blog about cold weather emergencies, and it would be great to include everybody's tips and tricks. Of course, you can always go over to the Medicast forums and start a forum post over there on cold weather tips and tricks and things that people do to keep people warm and keep themselves warm. And you can do that by going to forums.medicast.com. So you can go ahead and check that out at the Medicast forums. As always, contact me at podmedic@mac.com if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or yes, corrections for anything I talk about in the show. And always head over to medicast.com for the show notes in the blog there for this and every other podcast episode. All right, folks, I want to thank you all for joining me. If you have any further questions, shoot me emails, and we'll be back again next month. We're going to be showing up next month, the second Tuesday in December, and I believe that's December 9th. On December 9th, we'll be talking about EMS stress and talking about different things we do to manage our stress. This is kind of a topic I tend to revisit about once a year. It's because I think it's something that's important for us to revisit on a regular basis and talk about the times when we've had some issues dealing with it. You know, it's not a question of whether you can deal with your stress situations. It's not a question of, you know, that you may not ever have a stressful situation occur in your EMS career. It's just a question of when. Everybody runs into those calls, those situations that somehow strike closer to home than they'd like. And it's how you work with stress in your life and how you are open and look for your resources to help you get through your stressful times that are going to be determining both your home life and your professional life, how well you handle these situations. And understand that stress is something we all deal with and we all handle differently. So we're going to go ahead and talk about that next month. So I'm looking forward to having everybody joining us again. And first of all, I want to say everybody have a great Thanksgiving holiday if you're listening to this in the U.S. and enjoy your Thanksgiving here coming up in a couple of weeks. And be safe in the meantime. And I will again end as I always do by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Don't forget, folks, scene safety, BSI.